Welcome to Historically St. Pete, a weekly conversation where we explore the truth and possibly the myths of the people and events that created the Sunshine City. My name is Rui Frias, and I have the coolest job in town. I'm the executive director of the St. Petersburg Museum of History. Located on the St. Pete Pier, the Museum of History has been sharing the stories of the Sunshine City for 102 years, and we're happy to share those stories with you here on Radio St. Pete. When the modern civil rights movement is taught in high schools here in Pinellas County, students always learn about Montgomery, Selma, Birmingham, Memphis, but never St. Petersburg. From lunch counter sit-ins and freedom riders to segregated dance venues and sanitation strikes, it all happened here in the Sunshine City as well. Our guest today is Dr. Ray Arsenault. Dr. Arsenault taught at the University of South Florida, St. Pete, for 40-plus years. He co-founded the Florida Studies Program and specialized in the political, social, and environmental history of the American South. Ray is also the author or editor of 12 books, including St. Petersburg and the Florida Dream, 1888 to 1950, Freedom Riders, 1961 and the Struggle for Racial Justice, The Sound of Freedom, Marian Anderson, the Lincoln Memorial, and the Concert that Awakened America, Arthur Ashe, A Life, and John Lewis, In Search of the Beloved Community. Welcome, Ray. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
I know there's much too much civil rights history in our area to cover in 25 minutes, so we're just going to jump right in. First of all, let's talk a little bit about that 1940 interracial coalition.
Well, I think you can sort of locate the origins of the civil rights struggle in St. Pete with the fight against the slumlords in 1940. It was an interracial coalition that was trying to allow a second phase of the Jordan Park public housing project, which the first part filled right up, and they wanted to do a second part, and because there was a lot of substandard housing on the South Side in the black community, and people were desperate to improve their lives in terms of housing. Anyway, so the League of Women Voters and some other groups, ministerial associations, black and white, came together, and they were able to carry in a referendum against a pretty powerful coalition of slumlords. And that was sort of the first victory, the first inkling of kind of interracial cooperation and of that really things could change.
So, as you said, that pretty much, kind of kicked off the modern civil rights movement here. And it kind of sped up pretty quickly after that, especially after World War II, I guess. And a lot of people, when we talk about this at the museum, that it's almost hard to believe that how segregated St. Petersburg was, because, let's face it, there are like three original people from here, right? And everybody else came from mostly up north or the Midwest. But it was. And like I mentioned a few minutes ago, all the activities that happened throughout the South also happened here. But we had something that some of these towns didn't have, like wait-ins. So talk, if you can, a few minutes about, the segregation and eventual integration of Spa Beach and Spa Pool.
Well, from the early days of the city, there was cradle-to-grave segregation. It wasn't quite as intense as the Deep South, but not too far off, actually. Everything was mandated by law. The whites and blacks were separated, housing, schooling, you name it. And but one of the issues that really grated on people in the black community was that they had no decent beach to go to. All the beaches were segregated. They were allowed to swim on what we call the South Mole near the railroad tracks. It was just awful. And so that, starting in the 30s, that was a huge issue. And there were several clashes along the way. There was a black picnic. Noah Griffin, who was a really wonderful, wonderful figure in the black community, who was the principal of Gibbs High School in the 30s, he was kind of organized a picnic for teachers in Shore Acres. And it ended up in a near riot, and so the beach issue just kept coming up, black ministers trying to see if there's any way that they could desegregate the beaches, or at least have a decent beach for blacks to go to, a better form of segregation, let's say. And the things really started to change in the mid 1950s, 1956, actually, 2 years after the Brown decision. When there was a sort of a wade-in, a swim-in at the spa on the pier, on the municipal pier. There were a number of black teenagers there. I've talked to a couple of them who were part of that, and they said it was kind of unplanned, kind of ad hoc. In fact, one of the girls who was there didn't even know what they were doing. She thought she was told, put on your bathing suit. She didn't really know what that meant, but she was very proud to be part of that. And they ended up, of course, they were arrested and thrown out and led to a lawsuit, which, of course, in the wake of the Brown decision, they won by 1958 to desegregate the spa pool, as it was called, what's now Spa Beach. And so the city manager decided just to close the pool. This was done all over the South. Whenever the suits were won to desegregate the pools, they just closed them. But usually people got fed up with that and eventually came around. That's what happened. After a year in St. Petersburg, there was such an uproar because there was no swimming pool.
I mean, there's an iconic photograph that we have that shows two St. Pete police officers standing in front of, you know, the yellow do not, you know, cross tape kind of thing that's blocking off the whole spa beach, spa pool area. I mean, this is a community that, I mean, that's what we do, right? We sell tourism and beaches and sunshine and stuff, and to have it closed for a year.
Yeah. Well, you know, the distinctive character of St. Petersburg race relations has always been deeply affected by the tourism emphasis and the winter visitors. St. Pete was built, of course, it was a city built on publicity and first city to hire a city publicity manager in John Lodwick. And they sold the city as a tropical paradise. And they often talked about it. It was like a Mediterranean city, right? But of course, they had a large black population, roughly 23% to 25% throughout its history. And they did a lot of the work. They built the city, mm-hmm. but they were supposed to be invisible, because they didn't want people to think this was Birmingham or Greenville. It was supposed to be a place for an exotic tropical escape. And so they sort of sanitized the downtown. They didn't want black children walking through with towels and bathing suits. They wanted blacks there when they needed them to do the work, but then they wanted them to disappear, certainly after 5 o'clock. And that had a huge influence on the patterns of residential segregation. St. Pete wasn't a particularly severe city in terms of the violence against blacks, although there certainly was quite a bit, but it was one of the most residentially segregated cities in the United States. At one point, only Chicago was more segregated than St. Petersburg, and that had to do with this attempt to sanitize the image. In fact, in the city brochures, they always claimed that the black population was 9%. It was sort of the magic number. You couldn't get above 10%, when in fact it was in the 20s, of course, and they knew all too well. And of course, that came back to haunt them in 1936, when they, under the 1931 city charter, they could create a kind of apartheid district, they thought, and try to force all blacks in the city to live within a 17-block area. Of course, they didn't have any money in 1936. They never could do it, but the city council passed the order to force all blacks to move into the 17 blocks. Of course, they had no idea when they found out how many blacks there were in the city. It was physically impossible to pull this off, either financially or demographically. But that's I love that story.
And that kind of still radiates today with the with Central Avenue, right? Because traditionally that was kind of like the demarcation line.
That's right. And the only black community north of Central Avenue was Methodist Town. Around Bethel AME Church, which was built in 1895 in the congregation and was very important in the black community, but it was north of Central. Everything else was south, and virtually no blacks lived north of Central. Even when I moved here in 1980, you rarely saw African Americans in the northern neighborhoods, for sure. Snell Isle and Old Northeast and Allendale and places like that.
A couple of the events, and I mean, there were so many major events, obviously, in the 50s and 60s across the South, as far as the civil rights movement was concerned, but a couple of the big national events that kids do learn about, like, for instance, the lunch counter sit-ins that start in Greensboro, or the Freedom Rides that, you know, head south from the Washington and through Nashville. Did it happen here in St. Pete as well?
Yes, it did. Actually, there were pretty considerable sit-ins run by the NAACP Youth Council. That was often the case in southern cities, the Youth Council, which had a very different orientation than the adults in the NAACP, who really wanted to keep the struggle in the courts. But the kids often wanted to put it into the streets. And so there were pretty extensive sit-ins here in 1961. A lot of them on against Web City, of course, the world's most unusual drugstore. Mm-hmm. The 11 blocks, and Doc Webb was an incredible kind of celebrity here, and he actually built his drugstore, as they called it, on the outskirts of the black community, and he had a lot of black patrons. But he was from Tennessee. He was very conservative racially, and when they had the sit-ins, he thought they had betrayed him. He was claimed to be very hurt, and but they were successful pretty quickly. Also, the Freedom Riders, there was a Freedom Ride that went from Washington to St. Petersburg, and most of the Freedom Rides, of course, went into Alabama and then into mm-hmm. Mississippi on their way to New Orleans. But there were two rides that came into Florida: one to Tallahassee, and one through Ocala to St. Pete. And to the city's credit, and I think a lot of it had to do with the liberal politics of the St. Pete Times at the time, they sort of prepared people by saying, we should welcome these people. They're nonviolent and all that. And so they didn't get the kind of welcome they got from the Klan in Alabama and Mississippi. There was one Freedom Rider was sort of roughed up a little bit by this one white supremacist who walked in. But by and large, they were welcomed, and there was no problem about desegregating. And in some ways, that kind of broke the ice. Of course, that was the same year, 1961, that probably the most important thing that ever happened in the civil rights movement in St. Petersburg, which was the desegregation of spring training. Hard to believe that, 14 years after Jackie Robinson broke the color line in Major League Baseball, the spring training facilities all over Florida were still segregated. In other words, blacks could not stay in the hotels with their white teammates. They couldn't eat in the restaurants. And in St. Pete, of course, the Yankees had been here since 1925, and the Cardinals were here, been there since 1937. And this was sort of the center of the Grapefruit League. So it was a big deal if something happened in St. Pete. And Elston Howard, of course, the great catcher for the Yankees, and Bill White, who later became the president of the National League, they, like the other black players, were housed by local black leaders, and particularly Ralph and Bette Wimbush, who were leaders of the NAACP. But they finally decided, talking to Bill White and to Howard and the others, said, we're not going to do this anymore. And the thing that really spurred it in 1961 is that there was a salute to baseball breakfast at the Hilton Hotel, and none of the black players were invited.
Wow.
It was just this gratuitous kind of insult. And finally, Bill White said, I've had enough. And Bill White was from Florida, actually, from the Panhandle, and he was very courageous and risked his whole career. The Yankees left when local businesses and hotels balked and would not desegregate. But it was only a couple of months, and they broke down. Of course, the Mets came in the next year, and everything was desegregated. But it was very kind of grudging, St. Pete has always been more of a Sunbelt city than a Southern city.
Right.
Even though it had this cradle-to-grave segregation, you always had many, many Northerners here. I mean, the first mayoral election here was between a man from Indiana and a man from Michigan. That's sort of typical. But there were sort of Florida cracker culture and certainly plenty of discrimination, which was reinforced by all the residential segregation that I mentioned. But once that happened in St. Pete, all of the spring training sites desegregated.
It's amazing to think that, with all the activity that happened throughout the South as far as the civil rights movement, the marches, the protests, the wait-ins here in St. Petersburg. In talking to some Yankees folks from the club a couple years ago, this whole thing came up and about how all those activities, all those events happened throughout the South, yet it was baseball that kind of pushed this city over the edge, right, to start desegregating downtown, the hotels, the restaurants.
Well, St. Petersburg was very proud that it was sort of the birthplace of the Grapefruit League, mm-hmm. and had the two most popular teams in baseball, the Cardinals and the Yankees, for so many years. And spring training here went back to 1914, and it was one of the ways that the city survived the Great Depression, because they had the Cardinals and the Yankees, and they never the tourists never quite went away in the way they did in other cities. So we thought of ourselves as the center of spring training, and so it sort of hit us where we lived, I think.
I agree. The museum recently received some early work, some early artworks from the artist George Snow Hill and his wife Polly Niphill. We received a donation of pencil drawings, etchings, all kinds of things, of course, that we've, you know, it's like Christmas opening these boxes and going through them and looking at all this history. I mean, George's name is famous for various WPA era murals, but he's also infamous about one specific mural that hung in City Hall. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, he did two murals that are in the stairway going in City Hall when you go up to the City Council chamber. One is still there. My wife calls it the sexist mural. It's still there. But the racist mural is gone because in 1966, after pleading with city officials for years, black leaders, they got nowhere. It was the painting was of a kind of tourists at Pasaguil Beach and being entertained by these sort of racial caricatures.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty ugly stuff. I'm not sure.
I think it was actually called Picnic on Pasaguil was the name of the artwork.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And Hill was a good artist and very well known. The city officials thought, well, we kind of like the mural. Why are you so sensitive about this? And of course, it was really an insult to the black community that this was at the seat of government. You couldn't go up to the city council without seeing this mural.
Right.
And so at one point in 1966, in December, late December, there was a black woman sort of making a speech on the steps. And she was an elderly woman, and she had trouble controlling her lips. She was kind of drooling or something. I don't know what it was exactly, but there were a number of whites around, particularly reporters, who started ridiculing her, humiliating her. And Joe Waller, who was a stringer for the St. Pete Times at the time, a young black guy who was very smart and was the head of the local Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee chapter, he was so angry at this, he and another friend raced in to the City Hall chamber and ripped the mural off the wall and ran through the streets with it.
So before you go any further, just so the listeners understand, George's murals weren't painted on buildings. They were actually painted on canvases that were attached then to
that's
buildings.
Right. That's right. So he ripped the canvas off
and
ran through the streets. Eventually, he's apprehended. The city officials are so furious, and local white supremacists, obviously, that they inflated the value of the mural so they could charge him with a grand larceny. And he ended up spending 2 years in prison for this. It radicalized him. He became involved with the Black Panthers. He created the African People's Socialist Party, the Uhuru Movement, and of course, many years later, ran for mayor. But it was a shocking moment for the city that they could be the scene of something like this. A couple of years ago, I was part of a committee trying to choose an artist to paint a new kind of African American themed mural there. And we spent 3 years, actually, and we finally picked this artist, a white woman, who actually had lived in St. Pete, but was from Atlanta, and then Joe Waller, who's now known as Omali Yeshitela, of course, he threatened, basically...
To do it again?
Well, yes, he did. He said, we'll burn it down, basically, and the city council caved. So it, for better or worse, it's still a blank space, and of course we can tell the story, and it's the blank space tells the story. But it's a shame that we couldn't work this out.
So speaking of City Hall, it was just 2 years later after that happened. I mean, you had mentioned the Wimbush family earlier and their tie-in with providing housing for baseball players, but the Wimbush name becomes even more famous in the St. Pete civil rights history. Tell us about when Bette Wimbush made political history in 1968.
Oh, yeah. Boy. Well, Bette Wimbush was something. I got to know her in her later years, and I never knew Ralph, but I knew Bette, and she was an amazing woman, had a law degree, ran for the school board unsuccessfully, and then ran for the city council, and she was elected and became vice mayor in 1969. And I think a lot of it had to do with the 1968 sanitation worker strike, which is very similar to what happened in Memphis, of course, when Martin Luther King was assassinated. The other major sanitation worker strike was in St. Petersburg. Stokely Clark Michael came and all that. But anyway, it was a long, drawn-out affair, but enlisted a lot of white supporters. And eventually the strikers got pretty much what they wanted, although not all of them were hired back. But it was a real wake up call for the city, and that led to the creation of community alliances and kind of interracial contact, and Bette Wimbush becoming a member of the city council.
So, I mean, growing up in St. Pete, I remember the integration of public schools, and I think, I could be wrong, but I think the last one to hold out was in the north part of the city. So tell us a little bit about how Dixie Hollins eventually got desegregated.
Well, that was quite something. 1971, you think about it, Brown decision was 1954. The implementation decision was 1955. Most counties in Florida desegregated in 1967, which is bad enough, but Pinellas really didn't desegregate. They started in 62 with an elementary school in Clearwater, but real desegregation didn't happen until 71. And then the flashpoint, the worst flashpoint, was at Dixie Hollins, maybe in part because they'd always identified with the word Dixie, mm-hmm. even though Dixie Hollins was the first superintendent of schools in Pinellas County, and his name happened to be Dixie, but they, of course, they made Dixie was their theme song, and they had a rebel battle flag for their flag, and so when the
Black, I think it was a little Confederate general was their logo.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So when Black students started attending there, all hell broke loose, and the violence subsided, but it was a very ugly scene. You can imagine being a Black student trying to go through that gauntlet. And not unlike what happened in New Orleans and other cities and Little Rock, obviously, pretty much all over the South. So it was but they got through it, and St. Pete ultimately, of course, had a racial balancing program, which was one of the most successful in the country. That no school could be more than 30% minority, no busing program is going to be ideal.
Right.
Much of the burden was placed on the Black community, and they resented it. But it did desegregate until, of course, the Supreme Court changed its tune and allowed the court orders to be vacated. I mean, Jim Sandlin was this great attorney who worked it out won the desegregation suit and we really had a very successful desegregation. But, of course, the neighborhoods didn't desegregate. That was the problem. So if you had neighborhood schools, you're going to go back to segregation. And to some degree, that's exactly what has happened since they vacated the order, mm-hmm. sadly.
Mm-hmm. One last thing before we wrap this up. I mean, the city is preparing to honor 12 brave police officers with a monument outside the former police station. So these gentlemen, you know, affectionately known as the Courageous 12, how important were they to the civil rights movement?
Oh, they're one of my favorite aspects of the local movement, the Courageous 12. Of course, St. Pete was fairly early in allowing Blacks to serve in the police force, 1949, I believe it was. They had four. But they were not allowed to arrest whites. They were not allowed to patrol in white neighborhoods. Very, very restricted. So it was just kind of a little baby step into maybe a more tolerant culture. And eventually, by the 60s, it seemed so anachronistic, so ridiculous, in a city that was billing itself as a tropical paradise and trying to get people from all over the world to come to it. And so these 12 decided they were going to file a lawsuit, and until they were treated with the respect that they deserved. And so, but they really took a tremendous risk, and they really were very heroic figures that I'm so glad that they're doing the statue to them. I think it's absolutely richly deserved.
Absolutely. So, Dr. Arsenal, thank you so much for joining us on Historically St. Pete and sharing this sometimes uncomfortable, but very necessary history. I remember Gwendolyn Reese telling me once that if you're not uncomfortable talking about this, there's something wrong with you, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
And I invite everyone to tune in weekly to RadioSt.Pete.com for my weekly podcast, and stop by the Museum of History on your next visit to the pier and explore the rich and unique history of the Sunshine City. You can visit historystpete.org for more details on our exhibits and our new historic trolley, Segway, and boat tours. Again, thanks for listening, and join us next week on Historically St. Pete.